Association, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet. Christie Clinic, medicine for your life.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we will be looking back to the life of the first black heavyweight boxing champion in history, Jack Johnson. And our guest for the show is Jeffrey Ward, who is the author of a newly published biography titled Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson. It's published by Knopf. In the book, Mr. Ward writes that Jack Johnson acted on the basic American premise that if you had superior skills and ambition, that you could achieve anything that you wanted. And it was that attitude that helped to make him the most celebrated and perhaps also the most hated African-American of his time. The book is out now if you're interested in reading it. Jeffrey Ward also worked with Ken Burns on a documentary that will air on public television next week. In fact, if WILL-TV, our companion station, is your public station, you can see the program next week in two parts, Monday and Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock. And it has the same title as the book, Unforgivable Blackness. Jeffrey Ward won the National Book Critics Circle Award back in 1989 and is the author of a number of books, including a couple that he has written with Ken Burns that were companions to PBS documentary series The Civil War and Jazz. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you want to join the conversation, you're certainly welcome to do that. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief in their comments. That way we can get in as many people as possible and keep the program moving. But again, 333-WILL or 9455 and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Ward, hello. Well, hold on a second there. We may be having a little technical problem here with our telephone. We'll see if we can get that straightened out and take care of it in just a moment. Okay, now we'll try again. Mr. Ward? Mr. Ward?
Yeah.
Good. Okay, we got you. Third time's the charm there.
Hi.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure what the problem was. Well, in any case, welcome and thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh. Thanks for having me.
We certainly appreciate it. I was looking at an article that was published in the Boston Globe about Jack Johnson and about the documentary, and there's some quotes here from both you and Ken Burns. Mm-hmm. And I was really struck here by one of the quotes from Burns, who he says that he talked with people, men and women in their 60s, who said, my dad or my grandfather saw Jack Johnson and he was the best. But he said, then if you ask younger people about Jack Johnson, you'll probably get a blank stare. So how is it that a man who as youths, say, I think in the book, arguably might have been the most famous black man of his time in the world, in the entire world, now less than 100 years later, has been largely forgotten?
Well, I think it wasn't just arguably the most famous. He was hands down the most famous. I mean, he was known around the world. It's a puzzling question. I think a lot of people have asked that, and I think it's two parts. I think the memory of the trouble that swirled around Johnson and the white reaction to him is embarrassing to whites. I think it's not a story they particularly want to remember, and I think a lot of black people also remember the trouble that swirled around him, and it's an ugly period in American history.
Well, that's also something, and I think it's striking, and you mention it in the same article, that you certainly understood that at the time racism was very powerful in the United States, and yet when you read the things that were written about him, the degree of virulence in the media of the time, even you were shocked.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing this for about 30 years, I guess, writing American history and biography, and I thought I had a pretty good sense. I mean, there's a general consensus that after slavery, that the turn of the century, when Reconstruction had ended, freed blacks were pretty much left to their own devices, and in an increasingly Jim Crow country, was, you know, really the nadir of African-American life after slavery. And I knew that intellectually, but until I got into the newspaper coverage of Johnson, who, after all, was merely an athlete, a very, very, very skilled athlete who could beat everybody else in his weight class. That's all the threat he actually presented. The coverage of him is just so grotesque, and not just in southern newspapers, but in the New York Times and the Washington Post and the L.A. Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Chicago Tribune. I had never really, I think, fully understood just the ubiquity of that kind of racism, but just totally unexamined. It's in the news stories as well as in the editorial pages, as well as in the cartoons, as well as in the sports coverage.
Hmm. Johnson fought, he fought before fighting for the world heavyweight title in 1908, when he fought Tommy Burns in Sydney. He had fought a lot of fights, and he had certainly fought a lot of black fighters, all that he could, and clearly demonstrated that he was the best of anyone. He beat them all.
Right.
And he was on this quest to fight for the world heavyweight title, and other white fighters, other white champions just wouldn't do it. They wouldn't fight
That's
him.
Right.
They wouldn't meet him in the ring. And when this fight finally happened, I guess what I'm sure that now people today would have a hard time understanding is when that fight took place and when he won, what exactly that meant to people, both white Americans and black Americans, or you know, white people and black people any place.
Well, that's it is extraordinary what it seemed to mean, and when we look back on it now, as you say, it's hard to believe. The heavyweight title was an enormous thing in those days. If you were heavyweight champion of the world, you were thought to be the strongest, ablest, meanest man on earth. And in a world which was run really entirely by whites, it sort of by definition, that person, from their point of view, that person, the toughest, meanest, biggest, strongest guy, had to be a white guy. Otherwise, there was something wrong with the system. And so, beginning with John L. Sullivan in 1892, when he was the first gloved heavyweight champion, he simply announced that he would never fight a black man because it would be wrong to do so. I mean, now his real reason was he didn't want to fight a man named Peter Jackson who could have beaten him. So what he did was say that there was this principled racial stand that he was taking, and that was eagerly adopted by all the white champions that came after him, who therefore didn't have to fight tough black challengers, until Johnson chased Tommy Burns to Australia and finally got him to fight him. And when Burns was very easily defeated, it really turned the world upside down for a lot of people. They just felt both in Australia, in Britain, and in the United States, this is just not just an American thing. It's a white man's burden thing. All over the white world, there was a cry went up to find some white man, some great white hope that could take the title back and return it to its rightful owners.
He fought for the what I gather would have been called at the time the colored heavyweight championship a few years before fighting Tommy Burns, and he won.
And easily won that.
How much?
Just a sort of promoter's gimmick, since they had these very good black fighters who kept fighting each other over and over and over again, and some promoter decided the thing to do was have a black championship and see if they could make some money that way. But nobody really thought very much of that title. I mean, Johnson won it; he was glad to have it, but it just was a stepping stone for him on the way to finding some white champion that would fight him.
Yeah. Well, we talked about the fact that the white heavyweights would not fight a black fighter and didn't want to fight Jack Johnson. Other than that, at the lower levels of boxing, was there much overlap between the world of white boxing and the world of black boxing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was much easier in the lighter weights. That didn't seem to matter to people so much. It was the heavyweight title that had this special cachet about it. Professor Gerald Early, in the film, says that the heavyweight championship was sort of being the emperor of masculinity, which is a wonderful phrase, and I think that is how it was considered.
Let me reintroduce, just for anybody who might have tuned in, our guest for this part of Focus 580, Jeffrey Ward. He is the author of a new biography of Jack Johnson. It's titled Unforgivable Blackness. It is out now. It's published by Knopf. He also worked with Ken Burns on the public television documentary that will be shown on a lot of public TV stations, including ours, next week. So if you're interested, you could certainly watch that. And if you are interested in the book, and I don't think that you have to be interested in boxing to find this a fascinating story, you can head out to the bookstore and look at it. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Jack Johnson was born in Texas, in Galveston, and got interested in boxing fairly young. The story is that he fought his first fight, which he won when he was only 15 years old. How did he get interested in boxing?
Well, he didn't want to be a stevedore. Basically, the options for a young black man in Galveston, Texas, were very small. And you could make a lot more money fighting even for change on the street than you could working on the docks. And he was big and gifted and seems from the first to have been an absolutely superb boxer. I mean, Nat Fleischer, who was the first real American ring historian and the founder of Ring magazine, said he was the greatest heavyweight of all time. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But certainly he was one of them. And he was, I think almost everybody agrees, he was the greatest defensive heavyweight of all time. And he just seemed to have a gift for making his opponents look like dopes in the ring. He was amazing.
I think one of the sorts of games that fans of various sports like to play is imagine what could have happened if you could match up athletes of various generations and sort of asking, you know, which guy was better and which guy. You could put this fighter together, you know, if we could stage a match between Muhammad Ali and Jack Johnson, you know, who would win, stuff like that. How do you think that he stands in when you look at the history of boxing and you look at the great fighters?
I think it's awfully hard to do that. I sort of resist doing it because for one thing, the rules were somewhat different then. He was a master of a kind of infighting that boxers really aren't allowed to do anymore. They didn't break up clinches in his day. That was a legacy of the old bare-knuckle days. And a lot of his knockouts were scored basically when he and the other guy were more or less holding on to each other. He had a way of hitting people as they stepped away that was amazing. You really couldn't do now. And also, fighters generally were smaller than they are now, and it's awfully hard to sort of, you know, match up those computer things. I'm never convinced by them. I do know that Muhammad Ali said, although he was talking more about Johnson's complicated personality than his boxing skill, he liked to say, "You think I'm bad? Jack Johnson was the baddest man that ever lived."
And meaning the most provocative, the most in your
face. The most
face.
Provocative as well as a great fighter. Yeah. You know, I think it was a sort of the whole package.
Yeah. Well, certainly when you look at photographs of him, he looks like a man who would have been physically very powerful.
He was indeed.
I think that sort of plays into the notion that I would imagine a lot of people who aren't interested in boxing think that boxing is a terrible, barbaric thing, who think that all it's about is physical power and don't understand that, well, in fact, that there's strategy and there's finesse and there's all sorts of other things that operating in there. Yes, if you fight as a heavyweight, you'd better be big and strong, but that's not the only thing that it's about.
That's right. And what he was the master of having the other guy make a mistake. He just he knew how to provoke people into doing the wrong thing, into rushing at him and so on. And he kept up a running commentary to make them mad, and he was not only a great athlete but a great psychologist in the ring.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Perhaps that'll be others. Right now, though, we start out with caller over listening in Indiana on our toll free line 4. Hello.
Hello. I want to give a quick anecdote and then ask you a question and get off because I think it's more important to hear more about him. I remember as a youngster, for some reason, the racial thing never struck me in any way. I had friends, black friends and stuff, and intermingled quite a bit. And as I got older and I got into college, I met a person who was bemoaning the fact that blacks were taking over football and basketball. And I never saw such an effect on somebody. As you mentioned about the people not wanting to do Johnson, and when he won, how the whites in the world just went crazy. I experienced that with a guy, and somehow I thought You know, I thought about it a lot, and it just seemed to me that the only thing that really counted in his life was this interest in sports, in particular basketball and football, and that somehow if a black guy, and I would presume, an Indian or something else, I guess that may have happened with Jesse, with that Indian runner, mm-hmm. Just these kind of peculiarities. Now, I was wondering if you found in your research that this is just, the white man's burden, his sort of metaphysics he's carrying around with him for some reason. And I just can't see, I couldn't see people getting real upset if somebody, a black chess champion, there's a difference there. And it's rather startling. I wonder if you could say something about that. Thanks a lot.
Well, I think he brings up a good point. Actually, there was a cartoon that didn't end up in the film just because we didn't have time for it, but was that when he beat Jim Jeffries and became the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world, he beat the ex-champion, somebody drew a cartoon, I think it was in the Chicago Tribune, which has drawings of a black golfer and a black baseball player and a black football player and a swimmer, I think. I can't remember all of them. And the headline is something like things could be worse. And the point of that was it was inconceivable that blacks would do well in those other sports. This boxing thing was bad enough, but at least it wouldn't go any farther than that. And, when you look back, it's a sort of hilarious cartoon. But I do think there are certain people who identify in a racial way pointlessly with sports. It's beyond my understanding. And you can still see it. I mean, it still has, I think of the career of various white hopes who were promoted to beat Muhammad or any of those other people in our time, who really suffered because of it. I mean, it isn't necessarily the fighters; it's the promoting world. People will pay to see interracial fighting. It's a sad fact, but it's still a fact.
One of the striking things about Johnson is his attitude toward the racism that he experienced, and at least his public statements about his effort to rise above that, not necessarily pretend that it didn't exist. But, well, one of the quotes is he said, "I found no better way of avoiding race prejudice than to act with people of other races as if prejudice did not exist."
That's right. He's not saying that race doesn't exist, but he feels he should simply not acknowledge that prejudice existed. And that, in a truly Jim Crow country, that's an astonishing thing to have decided in your youth and then to have stuck to all his life. I mean, Johnson had many flaws, but I find him, his courage and his audacity just absolutely extraordinary. Every time he went into the ring, his life was at risk because people threatened to kill him all the time. People were found with guns at his fights. People tried to break into his house to shoot him. And yet, if you look at the films of him fighting, he seems completely oblivious, capable of joking back with people who were shouting stuff at him. No way. Whenever he fought a white person, basically the entire crowd was A, white, and B, had paid to see him beaten. And somehow that just spurred him on to greater effort.
Where this attitude that he had about racism, where did that come from?
Well, that's the great mystery. I mean, I think there's certain people you finally can't account for. I think you can't. I mean, just to draw some not real parallels, but I don't think you can account for how Abraham Lincoln turned out the way he did, or Louis Armstrong, or they're just certain people that are mysterious. And I think Johnson was one of them. I mean, he had attitudes, 100 years ahead of his time. And I think some of it came from he had an extremely encouraging mother who told him he could do anything he put his mind to, but so do lots of people who don't get anywhere. While he grew up in Jim Crow Galveston, the neighborhood he lived in, which is the poorest neighborhood in town, was also the most integrated one. And the kids he ran with were both black and white when he was a boy. And he attributed a lot of it to that he was never taught what other blacks under Jim Crow were taught, which was that they had to act a certain way toward other kids. Now, how much of that is true, I don't know. But I do know that it started early and never quit.
Something that's also really striking about him that you write about in the book is his the way he thought about himself and the for him, the importance of being identified as an American. The first chapter, the title
that's
is
right.
Pure-Blooded American, and that's the way he talked about himself.
That's the first, as you're exactly right. That's he wrote four autobiographies, and he wrote one of them with a French collaborator, was published in Paris before he ever won the title. So he very early had a sense of himself as an extraordinary person. And the very first thing he wanted you to know on the very first page of that biography in French was, he said, I am a pure-blooded American. And he, by that he meant that he was pure-blooded because his ancestors had been in the United States long before there was a United States. They had been slaves. And therefore, he belonged here. And he was going to act as an American should. And as you said in your introduction, that meant that if you had enough skill and enough grits and gumption and determination, that really should be all you needed to succeed in life. And anything else was irrelevant. Your race or your private life or your views on things shouldn't matter. That when you get into the ring, it's either you or the other guy. And it was almost always him.
One of the things that you mentioned, obviously, that during his lifetime, an awful lot was written about him. He also wrote about himself, and one of the things that you managed to draw on were some of his own writing about himself. And again, here, I suppose this reflects a set of unfortunate assumptions. One might think, well, you know, here's a very powerful man, physical, doing this intensely physical activity, this boxer, so, you know, what sort of inner life can a guy like that have? But he was, in fact, amazingly articulate, and that seems really to be reflected in the material that you found. And I gather this was something that in writing about Johnson was new. It was a new resource that previous writers wouldn't have had.
Yeah, he spent a year in federal prison on a trumped-up charge. And while he was there, he wrote in his own hand. Three of his autobiographies have, you can see that there was a ghost involved. I think they're all still his story, but people sometimes put it in other language. But this is his own, and it's in his own hand. His spelling is not always perfect, but his grammar is fine, and he knows how to tell a story. And he was what that is mostly is you know his descriptions, his own descriptions of how he beat various people, and he did it with he obviously relished the memory and had a good time explaining it. But he was a very articulate guy. He was a showman. He was in vaudeville for years and years. He made recordings. Was an inventor. He had three U.S. patents. He played the bass viol and loved opera and knew a lot about it. He was a student of Napoleon. He was not not the cliched boxer.
That was another. I'm interested in the inventor piece of this puzzle, which I don't know if that was something that was widely known before.
No, it wasn't known at all.
Again, a very surprising sort of a piece, another piece of his character.
Yeah. He loved tinkering with things, and again, the press presented when that was mentioned. It was never they didn't know he had any patents, and he would occasionally say, "You know, I'm an inventor. I like to invent things. I like to tinker." And they thought that was hilarious. The idea that a boxer, let alone a black boxer, would be smart enough to do that just seemed, you know, struck sports writers as colorfully funny. But I found three patents in his name, so.
We are already at the midpoint here of this part of Focus 580. And again, let me introduce our guest, Jeffrey Ward. He's the author of a new biography, Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson. It's published by Knopf and is out now. He also worked with Ken Burns on the public television documentary of the same name, Unforgivable Blackness. And that will air on our station, WILL-TV, next week. Monday and Tuesday in two parts at 8 o'clock each night so that you can see that. And, of course, if you're interested, you go out to the bookstore and you can find the book and read it. Jeffrey Ward is the winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award. That was in 1989. And with Ken Burns, he is also the co-author of two books that are companions to public television series, The Civil War and Jazz. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that Jack Johnson would fight anybody who would fight him, and he beat them all and had this continuing quest to fight the white heavyweight champion, and that they would not. And finally, it did actually happen. It didn't happen in the United States. It happened in Australia. And this was the world heavyweight champion at the time was Tommy Burns, who was Canadian. How is it that that fight took place, that finally Johnson managed to get the heavyweight champion to fight him?
Well, he chased Burns all over the world. He chased him across the United States twice. He chased him to England and to France and back to England again. And Burns finally went to Australia to fight. Johnson followed him there. And there was a local promoter who simply offered Burns so much money that he couldn't refuse the offer. He offered him $30,000, which was an extraordinary amount of money in those days, and absolutely unprecedented in boxing. And it was a guarantee of 30, win or lose. And Johnson fought him for five. His share was just $5,000. But it was not a sudden burst of open-minded liberalism on the part of Tommy Burns. It was just an interest in getting the cold cash, and it was a great mistake because Johnson very easily knocked him down within about 10 seconds of the opening bell, and then toyed with him for a long time, and then put him out.
And there were riots after this fight here in the United States. There were riots.
Well, there weren't riots after that one. There was general despair and gloom. There were riots after.
Oh, that was at the Jeffries
fight.
Yeah,
they were the worst riots, or the most, not the worst, the most widespread racial violence in America until the death of Dr. King. Almost any city you can name had racial clashes in the street, and perhaps as many as 26 people were killed.
So was that, did that somehow after he beat Burns, and there was this big in the white world and in the white fight world, there was this big quest then to find the great white hope, the man who would then be able to beat him, and he fought a number of other fighters. So was that somehow that particular fight mean more than what had come before?
Yes, there was Jeffries had retired from the ring several years earlier, rather than fight Johnson. Basically, he said, I have run out of what he called logical contenders, by which he meant white contenders, and he refused to fight Johnson. And so he had retired, and he was a formidable fighter. He was a great fighter, and very powerful in his heyday. But he had been out of the ring, and white people who were desperate to have things restored to what they saw as the natural order with white folks on top, invested emotionally in getting Jeffries to come back to the ring and fight Johnson, and as Jack London said, wipe off that golden smile. And their emotional investment was so great, and the predictions of what Jeffries was going to do to him once, if he hit him once, he'd never get up, he'd beg for mercy and fall down. I mean, there was all sorts of loony stuff. And when that didn't happen, and not only didn't happen, but Jeffries, who had never even been knocked down before, was knocked out by Johnson after another effortless fight. That just drove people nuts. I mean, they just went crazy. What often set off the rioting would be some black person who had bet on Johnson and maybe had a drink, and who would say something like "Hurrah for Jack Johnson" after the fight was over, would set off a white mob.
We have
It was an awful, awful business.
We have another caller here. Someone to talk with callers in Chicago. Let's do that. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello. You said that Jack Johnson was forgotten, but this is like the second time in my short lifetime that there's been a revival of interest in him. If you remember, I guess it would have been the 60s, or was it the 70s, when the stage play The Great White Hope made James Earl Jones a household name.
Right.
So there seems to be something very fascinating about him, that periodically there's a revival of interest.
I think that's right. And
I didn't mean he was entirely forgotten, but I do think if you ask young people about him, they don't know very much about him. And I think they didn't know in 1960 either. I mean, that was a new story. I mean, these stories come back around on the wheel again and again, and people look at them from different points of view. Now that one was a fictionalized play. His name he's called Jim Jefferson in it, I think.
Right.
So it isn't a sort of documentary look at him, and it's sort of Jack Johnson, I think, as he would like most to have been remembered in that one. He was a little more complicated than that. But it's a wonderful show, and James Earl Jones was magnificent in it.
Yes. And my second question is, you talked about the racism as revealed in the sports coverage of Jack Johnson, but one thing that disturbs me a lot, and I'd like your comment on it, is the racism that I see on the coverage of black basketball players.
You bet.
As I read it, it has disturbed me for years because it seems very prevalent. And the last incident in Auburn Hills, the coverage of that incident really distressed me because as a person who watches people in athletes, the idea that a fan feels that they can throw something on a performance stage, and no one seemed outraged about that. And I just kept thinking to my mind, if that had been an ice skating rink or at a ballet, there would have been real outrage that a fan could feel that they could endanger someone in that way. And there wasn't. Instead, there was the comments about the players. And to me, I read it. I wasn't sure at the beginning. I thought it was simply envy. But I really do feel that there's a great deal of racism in the coverage of black athletes even today.
No, I think you're right. I don't want to defend going into the stands and all that. I'm not a.
I'm not defending that, but I'm saying that shouldn't have happened.
But I agree with you that fans think they can throw stuff on people and so on. It is amazing. With Jack Johnson, they used to throw lighted cigarettes at his back, which gives you a sense of the level of that kind of stuff. And nobody, you know, he didn't complain. He just went out and beat his opponent. He was an amazing man.
Yes. But I feel that my comment is simply that the racism that you read in the sports pages, I think, still prevails today. I think, and it's solely covered by anger at the amount of money that they're making, but that doesn't seem to play since almost all top athletes make a great deal of money.
I agree with you that it exists. I don't think if you looked at the papers of that time, it's far more subtle and complicated now than it was. It was real simple then. And everybody, you know, almost everybody white who read those papers in Johnson's time shared all those views. You know, none of it startled them. They thought the cartoons were funny. They thought the articles that made fun of Johnson's speech, which actually didn't sound anything like the way they made him sound, that was routinely done with black people on almost every level. It's much more sophisticated and complicated now. But I agree with you that those feelings still exist.
Okay, thank you.
Right, thanks. In the book, in the section of photographs, there's a photograph from the fight that Jack Johnson fought Stanley Ketchell, who he fought before Jeffries. And actually, Ketchell was even he was a middleweight. Apparently,
right,
he was
the middleweight champion.
He was smaller, but the white boxing world was intent on finding some white fighter who could beat Johnson. So put this guy in the ring who was smaller.
Yep.
And the thing that I'm thinking about and looking at this particular picture, you see a section of the crowd watching the fight.
Right.
There is one. As far as I can tell, there is one, count them, one African-American man who is there watching the fight. Could black people go to the fights? Did any black people go to these fights?
But they didn't go, but you wouldn't see them at ringside because those were even then very expensive, relatively very expensive seats. Mm-hmm. And very few black people had that kind of money. But that guy got there, and he's sort of unaccountable. The thing I love about that picture is that everybody is at least shocked, and some are horrified to see Johnson standing over a totally unconscious Stanley Ketchell.
He's flat on his back
for quite a while,
sprawled out staring up at the sky. And Johnson looks a little concerned. He's worried that he might have actually hurt him. And the one face in that crowd that is not either shocked or horrified is the black man who, at least the way I look at it, is trying to suppress a grin.
Mm-hmm. Fair description of the photo. That's great. Let's talk with someone else here. We have someone in a nearby community, Belgium, over by Danville, line number one. Hello.
Good morning, sir. I haven't heard you say anything what happened to Jack Johnson after he stopped fighting. Where did his life go from that? When did he pass? That sort of information?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, he, as I said, he served some time in Leavenworth. He got out, and by then he was 43 years old. He was really too old to be considered a serious fighter, although he tried very hard. He wanted to get a fight with Jack Dempsey and so on. He went into vaudeville. He was in. He became a sort of sideshow attraction. He appeared on stage quite a lot. Tried to become a boxing manager and trainer. He was like most athletes when their athletic careers are over. They're a little bit sad, but with Johnson, he never lost his panache. He was always sharp. He always had a beautiful car. He was married to his third wife quite happily, I think. And he lived till 1946 when he was touring Texas with a sort of a sideshow, signing autographs and so on, and was driving north into North Carolina, and he got refused service, or he was forced to eat in the kitchen in a diner, and he got mad, and he roared out onto the highway and came around a curve. He always had driven too fast, but I think this was particularly, he's particularly annoyed by this, and came around a curve, and when a truck was coming, and went into a telephone pole and died.
It's unfortunate. There was a play or a movie about the emperor or something or other years ago. Was that about him? About a black man and kind of like, was the emperor of some island or something?
Oh, Emperor Jones?
Yes.
No, that was not about him. Oh. But Paul Robeson, who was the star in that, actually did play him. Even during his lifetime, I think it was 1926 or 1927, it was a very bad play that appeared on Broadway briefly called Black Boy. It's the same title as Richard Wright's later book, which was obviously about him. And Paul Robeson played him, and he was one of the first. Broadway appearances by Paul Robeson. The play was terrible. Everybody thought Robeson was terrific, and Johnson greatly objected to it. It was a pretty awful racist play, and his wife actually wrote a letter of protest about it.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks for the call. His last big fight, Johnson's last big fight, was in Havana. This mm-hmm. was in, he fought Jess Willard in Havana, 1915. Johnson was 37, and he lost. That's mm-hmm. when he lost his title. And there has been for some time some controversy about this fight, about whether or not he actually, you know, lost or whether he threw the fight.
Right. Everybody, you know, anybody who's interested in boxing history has their own opinion about it. My view, having read a lot of stuff, is that he certainly did lose the fight. Also, having watched the footage very carefully, you can see him get hit with a good right hand, and he clutches at Willard on the way down, which I think you wouldn't do if you were taking a dive, as the phrase goes. And he had tried to bet $10,000 on himself the night before and couldn't find any takers. Now, I don't think that's something you do if you're planning to lose. The reason people say he threw it was that he said it. Afterwards, he claimed that he had been paid to take a dive, and he based his claim on an odd fact. There's a famous photograph of him lying on the ground with his arm up over his eyes as though he were shielding his eyes from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And that used to appear in white bars all over the country. Any working man's bar had that picture on the wall somewhere. And the reason nobody could see the films of the fight, which show that was just one frame from a pretty clear knockout. But the films were barred from being shown in interstate commerce because basically Congress decided they didn't want to see a white man being defeated by a black man on screen. So a law was passed which barred all fight films from being moved between states, and so he could sort of build his case on that photograph. Plus pride, he didn't want to have lost it. In fact, he won the first 20 of the 26 rounds that he and Willard fought, even though he was out of shape and overweight, and he just ran out of gas. Willard was huge, and it was more than 100 degrees at ringside.
Yeah, this was Havana after all.
Yeah, and Willard, I think, gave the best summary of it, which is to say, if Johnson didn't throw that fight, he said, if he'd have thrown that fight, I wish he'd throwed it earlier. It was hot as hell down there, he said.
Let's talk with someone else here. Caller is in Urbana. That's line number two. Hello.
Yes. The black folk singer Leadbelly, in his song on the Titanic, has a story about Jack Johnson. Jack Johnson tried to get on board, and the captain hollered, "I ain't hauling no coal." And I wondered if there was any substance to Jack's being refused to board the Titanic, at least in first class. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Actually, there isn't, but I did figure out, and I was pleased with myself, I did figure out why it happened. Before the Titanic sailed, Johnson got himself and his white wife two first-class passages on another liner. And when the Cunard line found out about it, it was in all the newspapers. The idea of a black person traveling first class on a liner was inconceivable to people, and there was horrible verse written about it, and all sorts of indignant letters to the editor and so on about how could they have let this happen. And I think what happened was that somebody read those stories, and then the Titanic happened, and they put the two together. It's a wonderful song, and I wish it were true, but it's not.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Jeffrey Ward. He's the author of the new biography, Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson. It's published by Knopf. He also worked with Ken Burns on the new public television documentary, same name, that you can see on WILL-TV, our station, next week, Monday and Tuesday, and other public television stations around the country, too. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We haven't really talked very much about his personal life, which was the subject of at least as much, if not more, controversy than his professional life. His being the boxer that he was and beating the white fighters would have been enough to make him a very controversial figure, but he was a man who he liked flashy clothes and flashy cars and flashy women, and was married to two white women, which I'm sure, again, given the atmosphere of the time, even jacking up the level of hatred and virulent racism and all the stuff that was aimed at him, even more than his boxing, was his love life.
That's right. He married three white women. He simply, you know, in that area of his life too, he saw no reason to accept any limitations. He was a free American, and he loved women, and he gave various explanations for why he ended up. He traveled with a lot of white women before he married any of them, all of whom he introduced as Mrs. Jack Johnson, though the first ones weren't. But again, except for the fact that he was black, he acted exactly the way other heavyweight champions had. John L. Sullivan and Jim Corbett traveled with women who were not, who introduced women who were not their wives as their wives and traveled with them on trains and checked into hotels with them and so on. It's the fact of his color that made the difference. And he knew that, and it in a funny way, I think it both angered and mystified him. I think he genuinely couldn't understand why anybody gave a damn. He said it many times. He said, "I'm not a slave. Nobody can tell me who will be my companion." And I think he genuinely loved all three of his wives. their relationships were complicated, and he was not a model of fidelity.
Yeah.
But I think his marriages were, you know, genuine. He was very fond of those women.
Well, there you make a point that you know, in his, yes, we talk about his flamboyant lifestyle, but as you say, he wasn't really doing anything different than other black, than the other celebrated boxing champions.
That's right. He was what was then called, it's a wonderful word, he was called a sport. And they had flashy clothes. Mm-hmm. They had cars. As soon as cars came in, they wore a lot of jewelry, and they had beautiful women on each arm. And that's how, you know, gamblers, racetrack people, people who hung around boxing, and those, they were of, you know, of all colors and shapes and sizes, but they had those interests, they had good times in mind. And Jack Johnson was just another one. He just happened to be black.
You want to tell the story of his being charged under the Mann Act?
Sure. The Mann Act was passed to stop traffic in interstate traffic in prostitutes. The object was to destroy what was called the white slave traffic. But it was used in 1912 by the federal government to get him. And there are plenty in the book. There are plenty of memos from the Justice Department that show that that's really what they set out to do. They set out to make an example of Johnson as a black man, and to warn other black people of the dangers of what was then called miscegenation, the mixing of the races. And they found an ex-girlfriend of his whose train fare he had paid from Pittsburgh to Chicago. And she was a prostitute, but he wasn't in the prostitution business. She wasn't acting as a prostitute when he paid the train fare. He just did it as a favor to her. And they used that. They pressured her into testifying against him, and found him. It took about 2 hours for 12 white men in Chicago to find him guilty, although it was never entirely clear what he was guilty of, except buying that train ticket. And the prosecutor on the steps of the courthouse when it was over said that Johnson may or may not have been guilty of a crime, but it had been an important case because it was a warning to African Americans of the dangers of miscegenation.
He was convicted, and when conviction was in its appeal phase, he left the United States.
And, that's right. He fled the country. He was gone for 7 years of self-imposed exile. Then he finally came back and faced the music and served his time.
Yeah. What led him to come back?
He was tired of being in Europe. He really wasn't making any money anymore as a fighter. He missed what was left of his family. His mother had died while he was gone, which was a terrible blow to him. He was very, very close to his mother. And he wanted to come home. And I also think when he came home, various people had told him they thought he could beat the rap, or they'd get a pardon, or that he'd somehow not have to actually serve. But he ended up serving the time. All the people who said they were going to help him didn't help him.
Another caller here in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello. My question is, I guess, a segue to what you just talked about, Jack Johnson's apparent fondness of women of Caucasian persuasion at a time then, even more so than now, where that can get a black man in serious trouble. My question, however, is, did his open fondness for white women alienate him within the African-American community, especially African-American women?
Yes. One of the things I always resist is saying, you know, people say, what did the African-American community think of him? Well, African-Americans had as many opinions about him as there were African-Americans, and there were lots of people who never wavered in their loyalty to him. There were middle-class people who took a dim view of his lifestyle just the way they would have of anybody else who lived that kind of life. And there certainly were women who were furious at him for choosing white wives. And when his first wife killed herself, which she did in 1912, the preacher at the funeral excoriated black women in the women in the congregation for having been cruel to her. Now, whether or not they were cruel to her, I have, you know, I have no way of knowing. But I think, there were all kinds of opinions about Jack Johnson.
Okay, well, thank you, sir.
That's all right.
What about in among those people you would consider to be the intellectual leadership of African America at the time? Particularly, I'm thinking of someone like W.E.B. Du Bois.
Well, W.E.B. Du Bois, I think, you know, didn't think much of boxing and didn't think much of Johnson, I think, in his private life, but defended absolutely his right to live the life he wanted to live and to marry whom he wanted to marry and to... And the title for the book and the show come from him, because he said in the end the only way he could see to account for Johnson's the enormous white hostility to Johnson was not his character, although that's what some people sometimes claimed it was. After all, he said, whites didn't object to the characters of other athletes or even statesmen, but what Du Bois called Johnson's, in the end, it was what Du Bois called Johnson's unforgivable blackness. Hmm.
Well, there we must stop with the reminder that if you want to read the story, and there certainly it's a fascinating story and there's a lot to it, look for the book, Unforgivable Blackness. It's published by Knopf by our guest Jeffrey Ward. And also you can see the public television documentary. You're here in the WILL TV viewing area. You can see the program, same title, Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson, next week, Monday and Tuesday nights, each night beginning at 8 o'clock. Mr. Ward, I want to say thank you very much for giving us your time.
Thank you.
Our program, Focus 580, made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from REMAX Realty Associates, currently handling over 30% of the real estate sales transactions in Champaign County. Information at 352-5700. REMAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting. Later today on the Afternoon Magazine, a consumer-oriented topic, Celeste Quinn will be taking a look at cell phones, plans, and service with one of the editors of Consumer Reports magazine. The magazine reports in its February issue that that households with landlines and cell phones spend an average of $1,400 a year for service. She'll be talking with David Heim, who has some strategies for saving money. That follows the 1 o'clock news. In the next part of this show, we will be talking with Stanley Coren. He's a psychologist at the University of British Columbia, well known around the world as an authority on dog behavior. We'll talk about his recent book, How Dogs Think, Understanding the Canine Mind. First, though, we'll break for news, update on the markets. Stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education.